I'm happy to be here and glad that we have an opportunity to talk about food programs. It's something that gets me out of the office and is an important part of my interest and research. And I've had the opportunity to work on some of the Iowa programs as well, and currently collaborating on some school meal programs with the city of Des Moines. So this is an interesting part of my work, and I think very important to both the health of children as well as it will have long-run implications for their growing up to be healthy adults. Other programs address roles of adults. Okay. So I wanted to spend just some time giving a little bit of background on USDA food programs and talk about how recent changes very briefly, but give you some opening to think about why the changes in a number of food programs have come about. I want to focus on school meals, and then I'm going to try to allow time for discussion and any questions, because there are a lot of changes underway. As a sort of overview of USDA, Department of Agriculture's food programs that have a significant effect on federal support for a number of programs in as a safety net to families as well as in the food and nutrition area. These are the major food assistance programs that USDA supports, and I think it's useful to see the scope that both in terms of participation and in budget. The largest in terms of budget is the SNAP, what used to be food stamps program. Of the food programs that that USDA has, the national or SNAP supports or provides assistance to families in form of income that is to be used for the purchase of food. And for most families, it displaces other income that's spent for something else. There are very little requirements on what types of foods to eat. So some of the proposals that you see look specifically at the kinds of foods that might be allowed for purchase under SNAP. There's increasing discussion about eligibility and the enrollment in SNAP. But it's the major food assistance or nutrition assistance program. This national school lunch program is in about 99% of the schools in the U.S. public schools, and it is the largest of the food program. Related to that is the school breakfast program. WIC then is a program designed for women, children, and infants. It has major changes that have been implemented within the last year on the basis of recommendations of the Institute of Medicine. And finally, a much smaller program, the Child and Adult Care Food Program, is one that is less well known but addresses the needs of very specific populations in need in terms of after school, provides nutritional support for daycare programs in adult care settings, as well as for children. So the USDA, for the last four, has a fairly significant role in setting the guidelines for what foods would be approved, what qualifies, and that's the effort that the Institute of Medicine has been making over the last about 8 years. I think it's useful to think about the diverse ways in which food assistance programs affect choices of foods. They provide resources, so the additional resources can be used for food. They can place limits on what foods can be purchased. Funding through nutrition assistance is designed for nutrition education and other efforts to promote healthy eating. Nutrition assistance programs can affect food prices. both directly and indirectly through agricultural markets, and ultimately reduce food insecurity and hunger. So it's useful to think about that there, you could probably identify others, but these major mechanisms then are part of the, when we say what are the impacts of food programs, we're often looking at a wide range of effects, some quite direct and some less so. Certainly, for example, if you provide resources, it's useful to combine that with nutritional education to change the types of choices of foods that people might make. I mentioned that there was, that I've been quite interested and involved with the scientific evidence behind changes in the food program. The USDA has funded, starting in about 2005, I think, a series of studies designed to look at the new dietary guidance and incorporate that in the food program. This began with a study of the WIC program. We then looked at school meals and finally this child and adult care food program. And I was fortunate to be a member of all of those committees. The scientific evidence pointed to the fact that we have problems with overweight and obesity, that we, among our diet, we have fewer problems of inadequate food and more problems of choosing the right foods of obesity. Increasing fruits and vegetables, whole grains, and incorporating foods that are associated with improved health outcomes. So that kind of recommendation has, were brought into those kinds of, that kind of evidence was brought into the recommendations made for changes in all of the programs. As an example, WIC, which was, is a supplemental to women, infant, and children, used to be a program that, that had a lot of dairy products, eggs, and some juice and cereals that are fortified in iron. But the recommendations also added a voucher that allows households on the WIC program to get fresh fruits or fruits and vegetables. And that's a, that recognized problem that it wasn't so much inadequacy of protein in the diets as much as increasing variety and increasing other kinds of foods. I'd like to focus on the school meals program. Looked at the evidence of what was going on with school-aged children, and the dietary guidelines would made certain recommendations both in 2005 and more recently in 2010. Recognizing increasing problems of obesity, to follow the dietary recommendations was to increase whole grain consumption over refined grains, more fruits and vegetables, lower sodium, lower saturated fat, and reduce trans fat or eliminate trans fat. The concern was that the current recommendations in the school programs were also were becoming more and more complex. So if even more complexity was added, we had to think about ways to make the, to simplify menu planning. At the same time, making changes mindful of not increasing costs and not increasing administrative burden. The school meal changes were implemented, as with most regulations, in two stages. First, with the publication of recommendations of the proposed rule in January 2011 that took the recommendations of the scientific committee to implement the changes that we just discussed. And finally, the final rule, which was published in the Federal Register in January of this year. Recognizing the problems, increasing problems of obesity in children and overweight, Michelle Obama is in the city talking about some of these changes, both the physical activity and the issue of getting healthier foods for children. It was recognized that the old rules that set a minimum of calories didn't recognize the fact that, in fact, we are often providing too many calories for children in the program. And so the new regulations will have both a minimum and a maximum of calories or a calorie range increasing fruits and vegetables, they will be offered, whereas schools were allowed to combine them to meet a reimbursable meal. It could be either fruit or vegetable. They now must offer both fruit and vegetable. And I should say, for many schools, or for all schools, they had a minimum requirement that they needed to do. Many schools also offered more than the minimum. Yes.
Are you taking the input now, or are you waiting so long?
There'll be some time for questions at the end.
Okay, save that question.
Well, mainland Claire, I have to leave early. So.
Okay. That's fine. Do you want to?
Oh, yeah, please.
Yeah.
The issue I have with this for my grandchildren, who participate in after school activities, and they only get so much school lunch, and they cannot make it through that time period. And they cut back on the number of calories that they can have at lunchtime, and it's causing a real difficult situation.
I think that one thing that impressed me when in the deliberations of the committee was the range of requirements that children have. Yet, when there's one lunch line, they all are coming through together.
Mm-hmm.
It could be anything from the skinny 12-year-old coming through to the 16-year-old football player. And there's a wide range that needs to be accommodated. That's a real challenge.
Yeah, something needs to be
done. And I would like to follow up on that, and I know that would be really important. But that is a huge concern, because particularly certain ages, and I know kids are growing at vastly different rates at different times in their lives, but, you know, in our personal situation, we're watching kids shoot up 6 inches in a year and stay in food. And they're not going to be able to learn without having that food. So I'm very concerned about the low calorie ranges, because they're not going to make it into the school day. I mean, I see that person can absolutely be too underweight kids who are, their doctor tells them they have to have food.
These are real challenges for the school. There are two sets of regulations, and one I'm not talking about at all, which is the competitive foods regulations that are also coming into the schools, whereas the schools used to offer a wide range of fruits, competitive foods as well. Vending machines have been pulled out of the schools. So there is there's a changing environment in the school. And just from working with people in the school system, they are making an effort to figure out ways to best address the needs of the schools under the constraints that are available. It is, as I said, a really hard thing, because you can't have, well, this line is for the boys and this line is for the girls, or this is for the ones that have the high BMI and this is the one for the low one. So,
and I get that, but also food is better if it's freshly prepared, healthy food is better if it's freshly prepared, and it costs more money. So trying to keep it without raising, I'll see if I can almost impossible.
Schools are changing, but they are changing and they have changed. And so one of the challenges that I identified, especially with the school administrator, or school food administrator that were on a committee, was the fact that they changed a lot of capital equipment as well. What used to be prepared in the school is now made centrally, and it's a heat and serve or just heat cool. Well, if salads are very popular, but that means you have to have more cooling facilities and things like that. So there are these changes, there are funds set aside for helping with capital changes. There is a small amount of money set aside for some of the adjustments, but it is clear that they are going to cost, because there are some of these changes that are going to initially going to cost. You mentioned the fluid milk, which is another change, fat-free or low-fat, and if it's flavored, which is very popular with the kids, and it's why they're drinking milk, or it's part of the milk that they will choose, it's flavored and it's fat-free. One challenge for the schools will be the reduced sodium requirement for phasing over time, but a lot of the prepared foods that come into a school are have relatively higher levels of sodium, so that will be a challenge. And this additional fruits and vegetables is going to be challenging. Nearly 31% or 32% of children are overweight or obese. And I was just reading in the Des Moines Register this morning a report that in Iowa, 22% of third graders and 19% of seventh and eighth graders are obese. So this is a real change in the population today. Estimates show that we will save money both currently when children are still children, but as they grow to adults, obese children, overweight children are more likely to become obese or overweight adults, and so in the long run, we also save money. I know that I've already gotten one signal, so I'm aware that I want to be sure to allow time for questions, additional questions. That's the... Do you have one now?
Yes, I do.
Okay.
I'm sorry I didn't get up here right away, but I had a question, and it's with regard to... you know, there's many communities in Iowa that are moving toward buying local foods. I guess I know the University of Northern Iowa and the Price Lab School, they have put it in, I think Independence has gone to that, where they're buying fresh and local. Is that something that... part of this presentation today that you're going to be talking about, because I think it's an important step for us to look at. You know, it helps our local economies by buying our foods locally, and the food is healthier, it's better quality, and it's grown right here.
I think that there are two important changes in the sourcing of food that I find very interesting, and that is a major one where school districts do have the option of looking at ways that they can buy local. It increases the variety, it helps the local economy, and it provides probably fresher food. I have talked to some food directors who wish that we could grow green peppers in September, October in Iowa, or wish that we
could. Some of that's happening.
And some of it is happening.
Yes, it is.
So we're working on that. The other change that's underway, which I think is also very important for Iowa, is that the commodity program, which is now called USDA Foods, I think, is becoming much more progressive in the way that they deal with commodities. So they have become a major supplier of whole grain boxes, for example, to the school meal program. They've done recipes that test it, and I think that's another opportunity for looking at ways that we produce a lot of agricultural commodities here that move into foods that are used within the school program. So I think both the opportunity for local districts to have to school districts to purchase locally, but also the commodities are important in Iowa.
Could this be a federal school lunch program that allows school districts to use those dollars to buy local food, or they do have restrictions to buy food?
I don't think they have restrictions per se, especially the budget constraints.
So they get that comes to them in the form of money.
They get from taxpayers,
right.
from their budget.
Right.
From that federal part of it is reimbursed meals. So they are reimbursed for the cost. Can I have a little table about the amount it's reimbursed? And they have to decide, is it better to use that money in the for commodity foods or USDA foods, or is it better to purchase it elsewhere? And so there's discretion on what way to do it. There are also some vending contracts, some contracts that we are involved with, sometimes with other states, to buy efficiently for this particular market. The estimate on those changes for estimated costs was between 2 and 2.5% over the first few years. The requirements get tighter after that third year, and the costs were estimated to go up as high as 8% increase. And those are big amounts when you're talking about school districts that are right on the margin of being able to cover the cost of the meals. So it is recognized they're going to cost more. Labor costs are likely to go up. We've talked about the capital costs for cooling, for in kitchen preparations, things like that. Reimbursement rates are, these are the levels for this year. So for the children with income of 130% or below, the reimbursement is $2.77 or $2.79.
So does that cover the school's costs?
There has been a recent study, national survey.
Who picks up that cost? Is that the local taxpayers?
The school district. So there has been a national study that showed that that depending on how the schools treated some of their overhead and administrative costs, they either didn't cover them, covered them, or more than covered them. So there's a lot of, not all school districts are standard in the way that they incorporate some administrative costs of the lunchroom. The general sense from the community is that these do not cover the full cost. Some of the foods that are sold on cash are sometimes used as a way of earning money, but there are new regulations that make that more difficult. So there's a lot of pressure right now on school districts on how to come up with funding for these to pay for the required meals that they need to reimburse the meals.
Okay. So the local taxpayer would pick up that difference, or
okay,
yeah. Well, not really.
No,
who does? Most food services are independent from their district. They don't receive money from their district. Like we are self-supporting, and we are self-supporting. They get no money from our district.
Well,
and
more
terminal.
Urban,
yeah. But parents actually pay for the additional costs. They're taxpayers, but it doesn't run through the funding that you get for other school district funds. So it's the meals that we charge, it's our all our prices that we pay for.
So if they're coming in, someone can afford it, and they don't meet these criteria, their costs are higher to cover the cost.
They may be not in all school districts. What I'm supposed to do. Like right now, what you're seeing down there as far as those three kids, the 277 and the 279 that we get, we have to have our meal prices for our fully paid kids reach that. We have to take an increase every year until we hit that price. So it's the fully paid kids that are paying the higher meal costs because we can't have our 300 students supplementing our lunch program.
It is pointing to one thing that's very critical, which is that school districts want to do better when there's more participation of the students. If the students start, there's enough fixed costs that if with the changes or at any point the school meals aren't meeting the needs or interests of the kids and they start not participating, it hurts the school program. So we do want to have meals where there to keep up with student participation.
The increased cost that you had on your previous slide, 2 to 2.5% first 3 years overall, 5.2 over 5 years, is that calculated on the base, the slide we just saw?
Yes, except this is for the food cost part, and food costs I think are nationally around
45%. 5.2% of what?
This is, well, in the USDA's estimate in the Federal Reserve, they assume the same percentage cost on food would be applied to labor and capital. So this is basically, it's food costs are driving the assumption.
I want to calculate the total. It's a dollar impact of that. What do I calculate?
You can use it. You can use it on the full cost.
Of the 279.
Yeah.
277. Thank you.
I guess I have a question. And this may not be able to answer it. It's from USDA. How do they figure it's only going to be 2.5 cents because we're going to have to increase our fruit and vegetable offerings by at least a half a cup. And I don't know any place I can buy a half a cup of fruit and vegetable over 2.5 cents.
Currently, the requirement includes some foods that are being eliminated, or there's less food being offered. So it's a combination of less food being offered, as well as the substitution of these whole grains and fruits and vegetables.
However, her child still is not getting enough to eat, and is going to be complaining that we didn't serve enough food. So even though the regulations say we don't need to serve those, we're still going to have to find some way to feed those kids. So I would question whether that 2.5 cents is correct.
Actually, it's fairly close to estimates that we made, but doing it a slightly different way. So, but I do want to encourage anybody that wants more food to turn it back. I feel to just keep moving.
Like, they have a school meal. If they come back for a second, you have to tell them no. Like, when I was in school, I just remember going up and getting like peanut butter sandwich, or, you know, like, they can't come back for a second. You charge them. That's where they are.
Yeah. That's what pays the difference between the cost of the meal and what we're getting from the federal
government and the parents. It goes off the card.
That's right.
That's right.
I think bottom line is it's
going to
cost more.
Mm-hmm.
And.
Or it should.
Mm-hmm. So we've talked about some of this, and I just raise it again to indicate that it's part of the USDA's review as well as the current bill, recognizing that costs vary a lot by state. There are mechanisms that some of you may understand better than I do in terms of the mechanisms for price bidding and the way that states go in and acquire foods. Other costs that I've already mentioned are the new equipment and storage costs. If you're going to have local foods, would be one which may shift some costs to the local district that had been borne by wholesalers or distributors that are not local, and that's something to
well, I but there it's called partnership, and that's what the schools are working on and developing with their supplier, with their food supplier, whether it's meat, milk.
You know. We have, and in Iowa, we do have the opportunity for to do that better than some states, I think.
Yeah, we should take advantage of it wholeheartedly.
We also have limits on the climate.
Man, let me answer this question. The new equipment and infrastructure, is that eligible for payment out of the 1 cent? Sales tax, the money. The district has to find their own
PEPL.
Or PEPL.
Probably PEPL.
It's eligible expense under that.
Finally, an area that we're doing research and doing a lot of, and there's a lot of work nationally in on how can we help kids make healthier food choices. How do we support these changes? Something that you can't read here, but shows work, for example, giving kids alternatives between cash, a debit card, and restricting the card to healthy food choices. When you restrict, as you might expect, you get a lot more purchases of healthier foods. When you give kids a card that doesn't have any restriction on it, there's soft drinks and other increased costs. So competitive foods, what competitive foods are offered is one area that schools are looking at. You might hear it referred to as a school food environment. Nudging is an important behavioral way that we're looking at ways to encourage healthier choices. Lighting, having a shorter lunch line for the healthier foods, or making it turns out pre-commitment.
You
got to
make it cool. That's the thing.
Yeah, you need to
make
it cool. And so these little bag of carrots that have the popular cartoon characters on it go faster than just the ones that say visit healthy for you. It's not a message that goes. So all those things are being looked at. Pairing it, so making it something that is cool. So I'm going to stop now, but I'd be happy to answer a few questions if you have them right now.
Yeah. I'm happy to know what percent of students here in Iowa are actually engaging in school lunch rather than bringing
home. That varies quite a bit. It varies by grade level, so you'll see very different in the elementary school. By the time you get to middle and high school, those bringing their lunch or going off campus is much higher. I don't know state level.
State average is about
70% pre-reduced?
No. About 70% of the enrollment.
And you're going to, it will vary by district as to what share is being.
I think that's last year's school, so we might be just
starting. If you are enrolled in the food, in SNAP, food assistance program, you automatically are eligible for food.
One of my questions was, what kind of education is being done for parents much earlier? Because I think kids' eating habits start much, much earlier. And they learn to like things based on what's offered to them before they even need to know chocolate. And so, is there an education for parents when they first start feeding their children all the food?
Well, that was one of the reasons for new recommendations on the WIC program, for example, with the introduction of more fruits and vegetables at those early ages, and working with the moms or the senior household caregivers. We've seen it in the child care program. There's the FNET program that's highly successful, and people in the room that work quite a bit with them.
Will they start to limit the food products that families can buy that have those CBT cards then in grocery stores?
Well, through the SNAP program. Or through SNAP. There are certainly our proposals. Some states have asked USDA for permission to exempt soda from use of SNAP dollars. USDA has turned down two state requests. Some states have asked candy isn't allowed, but there's a certain
kind. Well, there's a lot of crap that you get, and in fact, we're probably thinking the food is just the hardest. You know, everything is getting thrown at us as food service directors to change and do this. But yet, those same kids that are automatically qualified for our program can go to the grocery store and food service or wherever they want to go and get whatever they want. And then they come to school and everyone is rejecting the meal and not eating it because that's not what they do at home. So it's real, there's got to be a happy medium.
You're right. There's likely to be a lot of relationship between what goes on at school and what goes on at the home. There is some evidence on the other way that if you can expose kids to fruits and vegetables in the school, they're more likely to be accepting or even ask for them when they get home. So I think that the hope is that good nutrition education in the school will work the other way and bring some better choices.
So families enrolled in the SNAP program, do they get any kind of nutrition training?
There is a SNAP Ed, nutrition education that comes through funding that comes to SNAP at a small percentage that supports it in the state.
One more question. Well, around here, as you know, when we're successful, we pass good public policy and we appropriate money to the public. If we could do one or two things and move the needle on this issue, public policy appropriations, what would you recommend?
Well, I think we've already talked about the fact that the school meals program, there are some pretty exciting changes underway. They're going to need money. They're going to need support. Even even transition support. There's a lot of, although there's some USDA money for it, the capital equipment, the local districts, the training of food service directors on...
So if we did one thing to start, we really can't be the best.
Could I make a recommendation to the food service director? Will they fund the state portion of our meals? Okay. Currently, we get reimbursement for meals served, and it runs out in about March. So the state is going to be giving us our free and our food again for the rest of the school. So those meals we get money through about March. They run out pretty soon. And, you know, so if we really wanted to do something, just continue our funding so we got that same funding for all of the meals that we serve.
I just met with the Department of Education on that point yesterday, and they said that the way we do a federal match, we use other state programs to do the federal match, and that's why we run out of money to reimburse schools. Like, well, you can make a deal with juvenile hall. The money that we're putting there has gone toward the school lunch match. I believe it's $15 or $15 or something like that. And then so that's why we really aren't putting in a true match. And that's why it's a little bit kind of February. And also, the state reimbursement for breakfast and lunch is going down over the past several years. I think it was five.
$3 to $4 to $5, $4 and $5.
So I wonder what that third grade retention impact would be based on a child that's not fed properly. I bet that is going to have an impact on their ability to perform on some of these tests that the governor is proposing. So.
Well, thanks for your question.
Okay, thanks. So our next speaker is from the University of Iowa. It's Dr. Linda Stetner. Oh, sorry. No, I said it earlier today. That could. Yep. Hello.